All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
All right, welcome to episode number 40 of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. I am joined once again by Mr. James Allen and Mr. Liam Flynn. We have got a few things to get through today. So we've got the preamble ramble that's going to be about World Cup qualifiers. And I'm going to have a big old rant about that with the lads. And Flynn's going to tell me why he thinks I'm wrong. We've got some football talk and we're going to go through the sort of roundup of the internationals. We're going to go through some managerial appointments. And then we've got Flynn's bike journey, which is going to be an interesting segment of we're going to dip our toes into the world of extreme sports. I suppose you could probably categorize it, couldn't you, Flynn?
I suppose so. Yeah, it was kind of extreme. Yeah.
Extreme.
It was kind of extreme. Yeah, that's like a really like contradictory way to express that.
Yeah, because I was thinking, fuck, we were super lazy on that trip. We were just fucking riding our bikes as slow as possible. But yeah, I'll go with extreme.
Well, let's crack on with the preamble rumble. So apparently the Aviva Stadium was sold out for the first time in years for a Republic of Ireland qualifier with Portugal. Can you hazard a guess as why that might be?
No,
not from me. No.
Come on, Ronnie was playing for Portugal, man. No. Ronnie, that's why. Big old Ronnie, let's get him in nice and early. Do you know what I mean?
I thought it was going to be like, oh, this is the anniversary of when they kicked out the English or something like that. Like, I didn't think.
But we're talking about patron saints. We're going to indoctrinate a new one in later. So we'll leave a little bit of mystery behind that. But yeah, for the preamble this week, it's going to be after a couple of non-event qualifiers for England yet again, as they beat Albania 5-0 and San Marino 10-0. Harry Maguire gets a goal in each and he let us all know about it as well. Is it time for a shake-up in the UEFA World Cup qualifying system? So I think the South Americans and the Africans, their federations have it right. They have kind of like, I think South Americans, they have like a round robin. It's like 10 teams and the top four go through automatically and the fifth go into some sort of like intercontinental playoff. And then the Africans, like they just basically weed out all the terrible teams by the time they get to their group stages. And then they sort of like have, I think, once again, another four that go through automatically and then another one that goes through intercontinentally. Should we get rid of the way we do it, which is like having England and having Spain and Netherlands and France play terrible teams and just wasting our time with these international breaks every 2 months, getting us away from the elite Premier League and the elite Champions League? What do you think, Flynn? I'm gonna let you have the first dibs on this.
I think the boys of San Marino might take offence you not calling them elite. They're definitely the cream of the crop of that small nation, and all respect to them. But yeah, I've seen your many arguments about changing the way Europe do things. So I had a talk with a couple of pals. Like, what's the benefits of the status quo that we've got in Europe? And I'll just kick off with a couple of points. How about it gives the younger players a bit of a chance to play, the ones who just turn up and sit on the bench for the whole tournament? What about that?
I would say, like, if they're good enough to play for England, they should be playing anyway, regardless of who it's against. I don't think we should use the international stage as a kind of like, all right, they're weaker sides. We do it anyway. Like England, like Southgate did it against San Marino. He put out the sort of like Ramsdales. He gave him his debut, played Bukayo Saka. If we were playing, mind you, Bukayo Saka started against in the Euros, didn't he, against some of the best teams? So did, and Harry Kane ended up playing anyway, just because he wants to get all his records, beating minnows up, semi-pros. Like the geezers, they have to book time off work to play against England. Do you know what I mean? That's like, that is the sort of guys we're talking about. So I don't know, man. I think that first point, like, you have a bit of standing, but for me, nah, it still doesn't warrant having these terrible games.
I tell you what, I'll serve as mediator between you two. I think I'm going to have to give first point to Flynn on that one. Moving forward, on to the next point.
All right, next point. So it kind of follows on from the first point. It's not super different, but it's a chance for these players to impress the manager and then possibly go up front in future serious games. What about that?
Well, isn't that what we had friendlies for? And then we've got the Nations League. We've got that for, right? So I think we have the Nations League. That's essentially, that replaced the friendly sort of system that we had, which everybody was like, this is a waste of time. Because at the end of the day, a lot of clubs, they don't want to send out their prized assets like Harry Kane, like Harry Maguire and, you know, Jude Bellingham, for example. And to play against these teams, when there's a potential that they might get injured, do you know what I mean? Playing against these, you know, sort of almost unimportant games. So it's a difficult sort of balance to make, but yeah, if you're going with the first one, that it gives younger players a chance, that obviously they're going to have the chance to impress the manager. That's kind of like the same point, I'd say.
you've opened up a different thing there, like the Nations League and friendlies as well. It's a lot of football in it. So there is enough games. It's not like you're reducing people or players by that much if you stop this format or even just reduce it slightly so the top teams play each other. I think I'm going to have to give that one to Bissett, man, even though he kind of conceded the point off his own back. I'm not being contradictory just for the sake of it, lads. I'm going to go one all here.
No, that's a good point. Yeah, to be fair, I agree with Bissett on that one. Though, what about this? So, usually we get players flying over to these games, hundreds of miles away, if not thousands, to different countries, just to sit on a bench. They're away from the families, they're in a hotel room, then they're on a bench the whole game watching their mates play. This is a good chance for them to get some time on the pitch. And that, I think that can only be good for their morale. And then by extension, the morale as a team, for the team as a whole. Like, could you imagine being in a team like that? Half of you loving it, you're getting to play all the time. You're feeling that team spirit. But then there's a handful of guys who never get on the pitch and they're not going to be feeling great. And there's a chance they could bring down the morale of the whole team.
I think that point is in the same grouping as the other two, which is kind of like based on bringing through sort of players that perhaps aren't the sort of starting 11. So they're not in sort of Southgate's, you know, in his mind, he's always got a starting 11. Every manager should have at international level. But this isn't, you know, I think at the international level, it isn't a kind of like, all right, let's give our sort of like B and C team like chances to impress. At the end of the day, you should be impressing the Gareth Southgate by playing well for your club teams, impressing every time you go out to England camp, making sure you're doing things right, making sure you're getting the right tactical knowledge in from Southgate, impressing him on the field in training first, and then you know you get your chance on the field. Because at the end of the day, you're meant to pick players in form. International manager meant to pick players in form that's basically doing well for their club sides. They're impressing there, and then they move up to the international stage, and that's where they get their chances on the field. So, in a way, yeah, I don't disagree with your point. I mean, I can see where, because that's how you bring youth players through. But I'll stand by, like, Walcott was good enough, man. When he came onto the international stage, he was good enough. He was 17 years old. He was ready to play. Jude Bellingham is good enough. He's playing for Borussia Dortmund. We know he's good enough to play. We don't need to give him minutes. Start him. Do you know what I mean? He doesn't need sort of like 10, 15 minutes here. He's ready to play. If you're old enough, you're good enough, in my opinion.
I'm going to have to keep you on point here, Bissett. The question was about morale. So...
Thank you. I was going to say that. It's strictly about morale.
Yeah, very
the morale. Come on, man. These are professional footballers. Like, there's not a sense of morale really with international teams.
In the pursuit of brevity, because we're right at the beginning here, I'm just gonna quickly side with Flynn on that there. About morale. How many squads are in England? How many players are in an England squad, sorry? Like 25? Something like that.
Well, yeah, they're 25 usually they pick for a World Cup qualifiers, they might pick more and then weed it down. But yeah, generally.
Yeah. So like you need to get everyone kind of vibing on the same level. And to be honest, I think that's what, during the Euros, especially as things got on, that's what Southgate was being credited for, about bringing them together as a group. We covered a bit on the podcast about the philosophy they brought into training just to amalgamate the players as individuals as well as the team. So I think, Flynn, I think your boys have advised you right on posing that question. Sorry, Bissett. I feel like I'm picking on you a bit here. But
no, it's fine. We're coming from the perspective of the sort of, let's say, the elite international teams. So I thought, Flynn, you were going to come across this from the point of like the San Marinos. So I would make a stronger case for them and it being sort of like their big moment, really. Do you know what I mean? To sort of play against these. Sorry, that was my alarm. I don't know what is going off at 20 past one. But that would be, I would make the case for the likes of San Marinos, Maltas, Liechtensteins, that they deserve a chance to, you know, basically play against the Englands of the world, Italy in qualifiers. But having said that, like San Marino, as we're going to talk about later, are 210th in the world. They should have to go through pre-qualifying to get to play the likes of England and all those that are in, say, the top 10 of the world rankings. I do think there needs to be some sort of mediator qualifying round that they have to pre-qualify before they get to the qualifying stages, which every single federation around the world does. So that would be my argument, basically. For why I think Europe need to do the same thing.
Fair enough. And for the last one, should we cover that one?
Yeah, so a lot of people generally talk about these games as if they're like a glorified training session. But my point is that it's still a training session, but with real benefits and consequences. I mean, you know, England could lose a game like this.
They could, at a very small possibility, of course. With any sporting event, we'll see that there's always a small chance of getting defeated when you take your eye off the prize. I can't disagree with the fact that it's extra minutes, but do we need it? Does that team need that extra minutes against San Marino? What are they learning from that? What are they learning by beating up a team 10-0? What are England learning? How are those elite players that are already playing Champions League football against the best players in the world, how are they evolving as players by playing San Marino?
It's a chance to not let Iceland happen again.
Yeah, but Iceland, to be fair to Iceland, they qualified fair and square to get to where they were in the Euros. They beat good teams to get there. Do you know what I mean? San Marino haven't won a game in their whole history, a competitive game. They haven't got a point in qualifying since in the last 20 years. So I'm not picking on San Marino. There's a lot of teams that are in that mold, that are in the European qualifying. Liechtenstein being one of them, Malta being another. Do you know what I mean? There's a lot of teams there that Faroe Islands that get to where they are just because they're part of this federation. But I would say let all those teams fight for qualification first before they can get into these qualifying rounds. And then we'll have less internationals where we have to watch it and it's like a training session. Nobody wants to watch England versus San Marino, as you say, if it's a training session. Let's have more England versus Italy, England versus Netherlands in qualifying instead.
I have to side with Bissett on that one. Squaring it up at 2-2. Squaring it up at 2-2. Badly muddied the waters for the third question, though. I've got to say, don't like your tactics there, Bissett, at all, man. Proper Jeremy Kyle, man.
So, all right, go on then, Jim. You have the final word on it. You have the final word. Where do you stand on it?
I actually agree that we don't need these this calibre of qualifying rounds. I don't know how the format could be changed to the benefit. I don't know how you'd end up weeding them out, but I do think it's a pointless exercise. I do think players already play too many games, especially top levels. Like they've got the league, they've got the cup, they've got Europe if they're up there. Then they've got like friendlies, then maybe the Nations League, then qualifiers, then the tournament. Like what? And then players, as Bissett alluded to, it's like some of them cost the clubs up to 100 million. So they're going to get injured, then they're going to be in poor form, then they're going to get criticism, then the manager's going to get criticised. I don't see the benefit, man. I think that this pushes them over the edge for no, where the benefit doesn't really match the potential cost.
And then Wenger's already talking about a World Cup every 2 years. So, like, honestly, that would just further exacerbate the issues. Do you know what I mean? So you would need, if you were going to move it to a World Cup every 2 years, you would 100% have to change the way these qualifying is set up. You just would. All right, so we'll move into, we'll talk about the international roundups. We'll quickly go over those. We'll see who qualified for the World Cup proper so far and who has to go into a playoff. And then that's the last international break now for 4 months.
Yes!
Let's stick to elite football, Champions League and Premier League. Get in there. Right, so we now know 13 of the 32 finalists for the World Cup scheduled for next year in Qatar. The teams that are qualified: Belgium, Croatia, Denmark, England, France, Germany, Holland, Serbia, Spain, and Switzerland. So they kind of it's the same old faces, really, isn't it? No one new in there. So it's
Serbia.
Serbia, yeah, they kind of flip back and forth between being a good side, don't they? I think they've got Dusan Tadic, who's a good player at the minute. Got Mitrovic, who's scoring in the championship.
A few big teams missing, though.
Yeah, they haven't qualified yet. Mm-hmm. So to be decided, there's going to be a 12-team playoff tournament next March, which will determine Europe's final three qualifiers. The teams involved will be Austria, Czech Republic, Italy, North Macedonia, Poland, Portugal, Russia, Scotland, Sweden, Turkey, Ukraine and Wales. So Scotland have got like the home seed, I think. And I think Wales are in the away seed. So potentially I think they could play each other. I'm not 100% sure on that. But there's some potential banana skins for some big sides in there.
You know, my low-key favourites, my guilty pleasure, the North Macedonian Giants are in there, man. I love watching them during the Euros for whatever reason, because they were, like, terrible, but they also would, like, have a go, and some of them were, like, 45 years old and had decent technique. Proper Sunday League stuff. Love it, man.
Yeah, Goran Pandev, I think that you're talking about, innit? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, Pandev.
He's going to be retired now, unfortunately, so he's not going to get to play in the World Cup, but they beat Germany, didn't they, in the qualifying?
Yeah, was it 1-0?
Yeah, I think so. Snuck it. So yeah, there you go. There would be your argument. There would be Flynn's argument for having the minnows in here. But yeah, they just have to qualify and beat all the other minnows first. So We'll see Lionel Messi and Neymar at the World Cup at the South American Federation, with Argentina and Brazil already qualified. We're still waiting on two automatic places from the round robin of 10 places, and then perhaps a fifth, as Peru currently sit in the intercontinental playoff spot. Asia and CONCACAF is still yet to be decided. However, Saudi Arabia, Iran and South Korea look very likely to qualify, with Japan or Australia looking to take up fourth automatic spot from Asia. And Canada, listen to this, Canada went top of their CONCACAF group with a 2-1 win against Mexico the other night, and USA dropped to second with a 1-1 draw against Jamaica. Mikel Antonio scoring Jamaica. Get up there, Connor Flynn. Thank you for that information. So all to play for there.
Man, the Asian Federation is such a dead group, isn't it? It's so dead. Not Saudi Arabia, Iran. Like, South Korea always, like, you know, when they fixed the games when they were, like, the host nation, so they got through to the semis by, like, absolutely screwing Italy out of it. Nerves. Do you know what I mean? That's the only time they've been decent. Big up Park Ji-sung, the word to your moms. Came to drop bombs. But for Jamaica, that is not a bad result for them. You were saying last week, weren't they? Or was it in the group chat that the USA are, like, pretty, like, they're surging for the first time in a few years.
Extremely impressive. They've got they had a median age of 22 years and so many months. The second youngest ever World Cup qualifying squad or team, starting 11 for the USA. So they've got young, hungry players, man. Timothy Weah, George Weah's son, absolutely killing it. And obviously you got Pulisic, who's coming back from an injury. He's looking like he might be going to Barcelona as well. There was talk that he wants to leave Chelsea. Who else they got? They got a Weston McKennie, who plays for Juventus. Really, really solid player. They got Serginho Dest, who's playing for Barca. Comrade De La Fuente, I think, who's at Barca as well, but he wasn't in this squad. They've got loads of solid young players, man, that are coming through. So it's going to be impressive to see how they do in the World Cup, because they are going to qualify. But Canada, man, like, you can't really name, apart from Alphonso Davies, who they play as, like, I think more of an attacking midfielder, just because, like, he's like the Don in that team. Like, he's honestly one of the best players, I'd say, in the top 10 players of the world right now. I'd say Alphonso Davies, absolutely incredible player, man. And he's got a hell of a story as well. I think he was like a Libyan refugee, moved over to Canada when he was like 5 years old. So he's just had a great story, and he's absolutely killing it for Canada, and their whole team's doing fantastic. It's nice to see.
What club does he play for? Bayern?
He's a Bayern, yeah.
Oh, man. See, that's sick, man. Because Canada get no love, man. Because they've been, mm-hmm. like, kind of the way America were, like, 20 years ago, like, proper unfashionable. No one gives a shit about them. Late adopters of the sport. But, you know, like, to be fair, as we're running through this, I always get a little bit excited for the African teams. Because, like, Senegal, Cameroon, Cote d'Ivoire, even, like, the little sneaky ones, like, South Africa, again, host nation, probably on the steads. But they are, you're gonna get a surprise from somewhere. You're gonna be exposed to some player. You're like, oh, this kid's unreal. And then, you know, the offers from Europe are gonna come in, and it's just a nice little, like, to spice it up. Same with the South Americans. You know, they're like high energy. They got some flair about them. Like, Peru or Chile can turn you over if you're not minding your P's and Q's. The World Cup's sick, man. I'm getting gassed already.
Yeah, you remember that, what was his name? That Shabalaba, who scored that first goal in 2010.
Oh, what a screamer,
absolute screamer. The Vuvuzelas were going nuts. Actually, looking back on that, I love that World Cup, man. I think 2010 was a good year.
That was good. But Algeria, that's, what's his name? Riyad Mahrez. He plays for them, isn't it?
Algeria. Yeah, Mahrez. Yeah, so the African Federation, and their format's a bit of a shootout. Like, there's 10 teams that advanced to, like, a qualifying round, a final qualifying knockout round in March, where 10 teams playing two-legged ties for 5 places available in the finals. Algeria, Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, Egypt, Ghana, Mali, Morocco, Nigeria, Senegal and Tunisia. Like, all solid sort of African teams that we've seen in the World Cup at some point.
What's the African Cup? Like, the African version of the Euros called?
Cup of Nations.
Mm. Yeah, the African Cup of Nations. It's what? Terrible standard. Terrible.
It was. I watched a bit when I was in Africa, in Morocco. Morocco were doing well at it, and yeah, the vibes across the country, it was going off. It was awesome.
I have a quick mention about Nigeria's team, man, in a sec. I reckon they're little dark horses, man, for the World Cup. Like, yeah, maybe get into the quarterfinals or something.
Really?
Mind you, the last dark horse I said was Turkey, and they got absolutely annihilated in the Euros, and it, like, lost every game, like 3-0 or something. I was like bigging them up. I was like, stick all your fucking hard-earned money on Turkey, man.
So what do you reckon about Nigeria?
I reckon they could get to the quarterfinals at least.
Yeah? How come?
Any gym.
What's up? Sorry.
Just talking about, I'm talking about little dark horses, Nigeria, man, the Golden Eagles. I reckon, like looking at their team, they got some really, really good players. Obviously, they got Alex Iwobi. They got Victor Osimhen, who scored, I don't know, 4 or 5 goals for in Champions League for Napoli already this season. Musa, who was at Leicester, I believe. Kelechi Iheanacho, bad boy attacking players. Yeah. They got Wilfred Ndidi, class midfielder for Leicester. They got some really strong players, man, and I don't want to put the turkey curse on them, the Bissett turkey curse. But I reckon you should put your hard earned cash on them progressing at least to the final. Quarterfinals. I'm putting out there now. Quarterfinals. I reckon Nigeria. They're going to qualify for the World Cup. Then they're going to hit up the quarterfinals. They're going to do what's her name? Who was that? Ghana. And then they're going to get beat by like somebody's going to cheat like Luis Suarez and get them out of there.
Now you watch them finish bottom of the group with an all-time low points deficit. Now you watch, man, they're going to nosedive.
16 goals conceded.
Yeah, they'll probably disband as a country after you've just picked them now, man. To be fair.
All right, and finally, the sole place given in the to the World Cup will go to the Oceania qualifying process, which we decided in March again, same as the African nations, and that could take place with the 11 teams playing in a mini tournament to determine who will qualify for the World Cup finals. I think they've had complications due to like the pandemic, so you'll have teams like American Samoa, Cook Islands, Fiji, Tahiti, Tonga, and Vanuatu. And they'll all surely pave way for New Zealand to have a crack in intercontinental playoffs to determine the last two berths. Because you are not seeing New Zealand lose to any of them teams, are you?
You don't think Cook Islands are going to kill it, then?
They'll smash them. So Australia's in the Asia group. What's that all about?
Yeah, I think they pick and choose where they go. Like, I swear sometimes they're in CONCACAF. Like, and I'm sure we've seen them playing against like USA and qualifying and stuff before. That it seems like they're all over the place. Like
they've got weird.
I think they've got a really weird way of like where they get put in terms of like, because they're their own continent, and Australasia is its own continent. But obviously, there's not enough teams there because it's basically like I think Australasia is just them and New Zealand, isn't it? And then probably like maybe Papua New Guinea. I don't know. Is that over there? Fuck knows.
That's just above it. Yeah.
So I really don't know how they're sort of like how they determine where they get put in terms of qualifying, but
to be fair, take it back. That's the worst qualifying group. That is a dead group right there. Man. That's worse than like Iran and the lads, isn't it? Really?
Yeah, because Australia are playing. They're playing in Asia, aren't they? They're playing China. They played China the other day. So
I'm saying it now. Yeah. Put all your money on Vanuatu. It's happening.
The Giants of
100-1 to beat New Zealand. Definitely, man. Like honestly, that'd be huge price. Get your one Poseidon on it.
Get your Papua New Guineas on it, mate.
All right, should we talk about the managerial appointments really, really briefly? Maybe like 10 minutes, spend 10 minutes on it, then we'll get straight into Flynn's journey.
Yeah, for sure.
So obviously Dean Smith, he's in at Norwich. That's going to be a tough job for him. Lampard turned the gig down, man. Who does he think he is, really?
Well, didn't we report like, that's a done deal last week. Report, we listen to me, how grandiose. We heard off the internet, then we told you lot. You're like, fucking idiot, man. Yeah, it did seem like a no-win situation though, didn't it? Like they're going down, aren't they? I mean, the same benefits still stand there for Dean Smith. You can have the rest of the season, get your best team together, do some business in the summer, and then have a good run at the championship. But as we know, the championship is a notoriously difficult league to get out of. You're really rolling the dice, like taking a job down there.
I think that's why Lampard has given it a wide berth, because he's thinking it's a bit of a lose-lose situation. Like, because Norwich, they're almost a certainty to go down. There's a very slim chance that a manager's going to go in there, turn their fortunes around, because they're not going to have much money to play with in January. They're not the sort of team that's going to throw money into invest and try and get themselves out of a bad situation and sort of like compound the errors in a way. So I think if he goes down with them, he would be stuck in the championship again where he was with Derby. And yeah, he was relatively successful with Derby. I think got them to a playoff final, which they lost, I think, to Villa. I think, was it 1-0 when he was coach? Yeah. And So if he went down with Norwich, although they're the one of the bounce back ability teams, like with like your West Broms and your Fulhams, that Bournemouths that always go down, but they jump straight back up. You'd have to say that it would be odds on to jump straight back up. But I don't know what he's waiting for, because I felt like that would probably, that's where Lampard's at, man. He's tried to do the Chelsea job and it didn't work out well there, even though that's one of the tougher jobs. I don't know if he threw his hat in the ring for the Crystal Palace job. What sort of role is Lampard looking for, do you think?
He probably just doesn't want to go straight back down. I think he probably considers himself a top manager already. Like, it's a little bit similar to Stevie G, where, like, you know, the speculation that he's just taken the Villa job until the Liverpool job comes around. But the thing is, man, I could have easily seen Lampard taking that kind of job as well, just to stay current. Mid-table kind of team, big fan base, traditionally a quite a big club. I think he probably does see himself, Lampard, that is, as being above a team like Norwich. But, and the circumstances being as they are, he's unlikely to stay in the league. I think he probably wants mid-table. I mean, like, before the Saudi prince took over at Newcastle, probably fancy him for a job like that. Do you know what I mean? But again, he's, as you say, he's shown his own level being at Chelsea and not being able to really compete at the top there, even though he started off quite well. Yeah, it's a bit weird. Maybe he just wants to, like, chill in the background until something a bit more amenable comes up. It's difficult to tell, man. But with Gerrard, he's taken the ball by the horns, hasn't he? And just said, look, and I can imagine he's a geezer who doesn't, like, hates losing. He just seems like that kind of guy. So I can't imagine he's going to be waiting around for another job. I think he's going to be trying to win every single game.
I was talking to a friend of mine about Lampard the other day, and he had a pretty interesting theory. He thinks that Lampard eventually wants to get to the place where he can start playing expensive football, like the tiki-taki sort of thing. And he's not going to be able to do that when he's managing Norwich. He's going to have to play negative football and very defensive football. So what do you think the chances are of him going to the Championship and trying to manage a team there, trying to play that sort of expensive football, getting some practice in as a, you know, as a fairly newish manager, then working his way up to a high-level Premiership team?
That's a fairly holier-than-thou sort of mindset to have from him, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? Like, who's earned the right to say, I only want to coach teams that play a certain brand of football? I only want to coach teams at an elite level where I've got players that can play like Guardiola's players. Do you know what I mean? Coaches like Guardiola have come from systems in Barcelona that have spent decades developing a certain brand of football. And he's sort of like, he's sort of a child of that sort of evolution of soccer. There's no way that Lampard can come out and say, oh, I deserve a shot at a team that's going to play this style of football. You need to earn it, man. Like, every single coach, no matter who you are, especially when you coach at the elite level, which is the Premier League, you have to earn your way, man. You can't just say, oh, I want to coach a team that's got all these fantastic footballers. Everybody wants that. Do you know what I mean? Every single manager that aspires to coach at that level wants to have players like that and wants to play that brand of football. Do you know what I mean? Nobody says, oh, you know what? I want a team that's like really technically inept, that just want to sort of play up to the big man. And that's the only thing we can do, just play Route 1 football. But there's no coach nowadays in the modern era that actually wants that. Do you know what I mean?
But also, like, if he can't impose his ideas on any group of players, that's his problem. That's a deficiency as a coach. So he might want to, as Bissett says, and look, let's be real. Lampard has become used to earning an obscene amount of money for an awful long time. And he's not going to want to go down to League 2 or League 1 and be like, yeah, mate, I'll have whatever you've got, mate. I know you can barely, like, afford hot water at the training ground. Like, but yeah, I'll take that. I'll work for free, basically. I think there's a financial component to this as well. Of course there is, like, especially after you come from a job like Chelsea. You've probably got a decent severance package there as well. But that is definitely a factor. But at the end of the day, you should be able to teach, like, 10-year-olds the kind of football you want to play if you're all about it. Like,
and let's not disrespect Norwich. Like, just because they're down at the bottom of the table doesn't necessarily mean they're not playing decent football. There's a lot of factors and a combination of things that might contribute to the fact that they're not doing well. Obviously, generally, it says, like, if you don't put money in, you're not going to get the best footballers. And they're not a club that historically spends a lot of money on their players. You know what I mean? They do develop a team and keep the sort of core players when they go up, and they don't spend sort of like ridiculous amounts on transfers. So if you do that, you are not going to propel yourself into the top half of the Premier League, because you have to spend money to get up there. Do you know what I mean? You have to pay for the best footballers in the world. That's just the way the system works in the Premier League at the minute. So obviously, he doesn't want to go there and show his coaching ability. Because if he went there, right, if he went to Norwich, let's say Dean Smith, because he is at Norwich, if he nearly gets them out of relegation, that's going to be a massive win for his reputation, man. Like, if he comes close to keeping Norwich up, that's going to be a win. So that's what I'm saying, why Lampard didn't take the job. Because in a way, if he just got them close to staying up, that I would be perceived as a success for Lampard. And potentially that would improve his standing and his reputation amongst the owners in the league. So I think they could, you know, perhaps say, look, he's done a pretty good job there. He's turned them around. They've won more points in the second half of the season than they did in the first half. And that's probably the way they'd look at it.
It's just another team in his portfolio as well, isn't it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course
it's just experience. And if you go for any kind of job, it's like, oh, what have you been doing for the last 2 years, mate? Sitting on your ass playing Xbox. It's like, no, like, look, I've been at Norwich. I've been at Chelsea. I've done this. Do you know what I mean? That all comes into it because it's big money, man, big business. And they're like club owners are looking to fork out millions upon millions, not only on manager appointments, but on potential signings as well. You can't take those decisions lightly just because Lampard's like top scorer for Chelsea. Do you know what I mean? You've got to have this managerial portfolio, I think, if you're going to get anywhere.
And look, don't forget, football management is the only profession in the world where you can completely fail at your job and get a pay rise. Probably one of the only professions in the world. You could look at Jose Mourinho, man. He hasn't been successful since when? Was he successful at United? Was he successful at Tottenham? He probably hasn't been successful since when?
I'd say he was successful at United, man.
Yeah, he got a trophy or two.
They won a UEFA League. Yeah, UEFA
FA Cup or something. Finished second in the league behind like City. Like, do you know what I mean? I'd judge that as a success, to be honest.
It's not bad.
Okay, so he's failed in his last job, Tottenham. Where was he after that?
Yeah, he's gone to Roma now, isn't he? And he's absolutely flopping it there. Like his team's doing terribly, man.
Yeah, so they're not doing great. Obviously, they've got but I don't think they've got Tammy Abraham up front. I don't think they've got many elite players. Like, you look at that team, I don't think they're ready for Mourinho to come in there and win him a title. Do you know what I mean? I think he does need a certain brand of player, Mourinho, doesn't he? I feel like he's not going to coach players up to play an attractive brand of football. He's going to go in there and get players to play dogged and fight for every sort of moment. Do you know what I mean? And try and win games by playing, you know, defensive sort of, how can I say, pragmatic football. Just to round it off, Rangers legend Gio van Bronckhorst has replaced Gerrard as Rangers manager. So that's a pretty good appointment considering they've lost Stevie G. And he was saying like 3 days before he went to Villa, no, I'm going to stay here. I'm going to stay here, mate. Do I look happy here? I'm happy. And then he's fucked off. And he said it's unfair. He said it's unfair to call Villa a stepping stone on his way to the Liverpool gig. He hasn't said that it is or it isn't a stepping stone. He's just said it's unfair to say that it is. So yeah, but Klopp ain't going anywhere anytime soon anyway. So, you know, can you imagine? I can't see Stevie G being there for like 5 years at Villa. Can you?
I can see him putting in a good three stretch there, man, at the very least.
If he's successful.
Yeah, but what does, like, as I said, alluded to earlier, I kind of jumped ahead when I was talking about this, but I do think he's a geezer who hates losing. I didn't see his Rangers side play much football, a few highlights here or there. I couldn't actually comment on his quality as a manager, what type of football he plays. I do know that the Premier League is the most cutthroat league in the whole world when it comes to top-to-bottom competition. And, I don't see him as a guy who is looking on to the next thing. I think he wants to win. I think he's very competitive. Now, whether he's up to the task and whether he's tactically astute enough and has the right man management skills to get through to the players at Villa, obviously that's just a great gamble of football, isn't it? But I don't think he's got one eye on the Liverpool job just yet.
I've got some historical standing about his interpersonal skills. So when I was 12 years old, my old man, we went to Austria, right? A World Cup qualifier in Vienna, England versus Austria, I want to say, yeah, probably about 20 years ago, 20 years ago. I think it was just after the 2002 World Cup, right? Gerrard wasn't fit. He wasn't fully fit for the game. So me being a sprightly 12-year-old that just loved football, loved England, we actually went down to the ground where the training facility was, and we saw Gerrard just doing some personal training. He was with the assistant coach at the time, who was a Scouser, by the name of, oh my God, my dad's going to kill me. I can't remember his name now. Anyway, he was with Gerrard. And as they're walking out, like by luck, they were walking into like his taxi to go home. And I was like, you know, I was actually buzzing to see Gerrard, like one of my childhood heroes, really, in terms of like the way he played. And I was like, Stephen, are you ready? Are you ready to play? Are you fit to play? And he didn't even look at me, like did not make eye contact with me. He just went, I'm all right. And then just walked straight in the car. didn't sign an autograph. Didn't, you know, stop to have a couple of minutes with me or anything like that. Just walked straight into the car, sat there. And then I'm going to have to find out this geezer's name. He stood and spoke with me and my old man for about 5 minutes. This other guy.
Steve Scouser.
Yeah, I'm sure he was a Scouser anyway. I'll ask my dad. And since then, I've absolutely hated the guy.
You know what? That reminded me of the time where I went to a WWE show and we went to the hotel bar afterwards and I saw Ric Flair and I asked him for an autograph and he just pointed at his drink and shook his hand like that. He's like, nah, like, this is more important.
I feel like it that's really, more egregious, to be honest.
It kills your faith in the thing you love, doesn't it, when someone dishes you like that. But obviously, Ric Flair was a chronic alcoholic for 4 decades and Stevie G was injured, so they probably weren't in the best moods, were they, to be honest?
Nah, but you know what I mean? Being a sprightly young 12-year-old, you know what I mean? You love
sprightly. I don't remember you being that sprightly. I knew you were in your 12.
And the only other comparison I can make, the only other time I nearly met a footballer was, I think, Andy Gray in the airport, and he mugged me off as well. Also, I saw Cameron Jerome in the mailbox with like a very lovely young looking woman. But to be fair, I was a lot older than that. I wasn't really as sort of like, you know,
sprightly.
Yeah. I wasn't looking forward to meeting him as much as I was Gerard. And I just shouted at Cameron Jerome. So I suppose if you just shout at someone's name, even if they are famous, they're probably not going to do much with it, are they?
Yeah, true.
All right, Cameron. Yeah. Cameron, you're right, mate.
Right, mate. I was bad, mate.
I once had a few beers with Stevie G and Ric Flair, and they were proper sound, so it's probably you too.
Classic.
Some experience. Well, that sounds like a bad start to a bad joke, doesn't it? Like, Flynn having beers with Ric Flair and Stevie G. Right, should we crack on with your journey, mate? Let's talk about this absolute fantastic journey around the world. Flynn around the world. What was that, tugger? The tugger boat?
Tugger around the world. Around the world.
They love a good fight.
So I don't want to do a disservice by giving an introduction to what you did. So I'm going to let you just crack on with it, mate.
Sure, yeah. I'll give a quick intro. So back in April of 2015, me and my girlfriend at the time, Jack, we did a bicycle trip from Barcelona, which is in the north of Spain. And we went down to like central Morocco and back again. It was about, we never measured it at the time, but it was probably between 4,000 and 5,000 kilometers, which is about 3,000 miles or so. The whole trip took about 18 months. 10 of those months were on the bikes. 8 of those months were like breaks. We took 2 big breaks during the trip. We lived in a tent for the 10 months while we were cycling. And that's about it. Yeah, that's the intro.
Mate, that's sick, you know. That's so sick. I'm like, I've been wanting to do some long-term camping trip, like with or without bikes, really. And I just want to get like the nitty-gritty, like the nuts and bolts. So how did you start planning for this trip? Like, what would you day one, here's what I need, here's what I'm gonna do.
Right. So what you'll probably learn during this story is that I'm pretty fucking useless at everything. Jack did all the, I didn't even exercise. Like, I think I exercised once in my life before this trip. I did about 5 sit-ups at your dad's place, Jim.
I think I remember you doing that. Like, I can do this, mate. Yeah, no worries. That was all day.
And then 10 years later, I was doing this. But yeah, planning-wise, we wanted to do a trip. We wanted to do some traveling because Jack had come over from Australia to the UK. And she really liked the UK, but then the winter started and it was a bit too much for her. It wasn't so much the rain or anything or the temperature. It was the skies were grey. You know how it is in the UK. The skies are grey for a good 4 or 5 months during the winter. That was a bit much for her. So she was like, we need to go on a trip somewhere where we can go for a long time. It's going to be cheap. And I was like, that sounds great. I'm well up for that. And we came across some blogs online of people who would say people who have done trips like this. These kind of trips are called cycle tourism or cycle touring. And the more we read about it, the more we found out that this can be really cheap, a really cheap way to see like a big portion of a country. Because if you think about it, if you camping, you're not spending anything on accommodation and you're not spending anything on transport. You're just using your legs and the bike to get there. So planning wise, yeah, I was reading about these blogs. Then we needed a starting point and we needed a few tools. We needed some clothes and we needed some cooking equipment. That was about it. That was all the planning that went into it.
So was there a point during, I don't want to say was there a point, I say when was the point at which you thought, fuck me, this was a bad idea?
Yeah, day one. About
literally day one.
Oh my God. Like, so before I went, you guys know Adam Scott or Baz, you know.
Shout out to Baz.
He came over to visit recently, actually. It was brilliant. But I remember talking to his dad before the trip and because he was a keen cyclist. And I remember saying, yeah, me and my girlfriend are going to go to Spain. We're just going to cycle around the country with no direction. Let's see if we can do it. And he was like, have you been practicing? I was like, yeah, I cycled to work every day, which was about, I don't know, about a 10-minute bike ride, maybe 2K is at most, and completely flat.
And oh, that's hilarious.
He said, Spain's quite hilly, you know. And I was like, oh, yeah, that should be fine. I don't think I'd ever really been up a mountain before that, because Birmingham's quite a flat city. Even though I'd been to other countries with mountains, I never really went up them, you know, by the power of my own legs or anything. So I vastly underestimated this trip hugely. And Barcelona might not have been the best city to start the trip in, because I don't know if you know how Barcelona, the geography of Barcelona, it's a city on a coast. Imagine like a square. That's the city. It's a big square. One of the sides of the square is bordered by the sea. The other three sides are bordered by mountains. So day one was brutal. The original plan was like, okay, let's get from Barcelona to Valencia, which is about 400 Ks away. If we get to Valencia and it was too much, it was too difficult, we'll just sell the bikes and we'll do some other kind of trip. But if we get to Valencia and we like it, we'll keep cycling and see where we end up. And that first day, I was like, fucking, let's sell these bikes now. So as I said, there's mountains that border the three sides of Barcelona, and we started going up the first one. It was on the way to a town called Sitges, which is this really nice coastal town. But to get there from Barcelona, you have to go up this really steep coastal road. It's beautiful. So as you're going up this road, on your right side, you've got like a sheer cliff face. And on your left, you've just got the Mediterranean Sea. It was like amazingly beautiful. It was like beautiful for about 10 minutes, if that. Maybe about 2 minutes, because those first 2 minutes I was going up the hill and I was like, this isn't too bad. This is pretty easy. And then straight away, I just started running out of breath and my legs are burning. And then
imagine, man.
This pure fire. And this road was really thin. It's like a weird, windy coastal road. So the cars can't overtake you. They just queue up behind you. And oh my God.
Pressure.
And we're carrying about 20 kilos of extra weight on both of our bikes. I've got a guitar on my back for some fucking reason. I thought that'd be a good idea. I barely played it on this whole trip. I was like, I need a guitar. So imagine I've got bikes strapped to a bag strapped to the bike, like tools in them, clothes, sleeping bags, all that sort of stuff, which, you know, the weight adds up. Guitar on my back, trying to go up this hill. Never really cycled up a mountain before. So I'm going at less than a snail's pace. I could have walked it quicker. There's a queue of cars building up behind me. And then I remember thinking, like, this is the stupidest fucking thing I've ever done in my whole life. Like, this is, what was I thinking?
And this is from a man who mopeded through the night in Cambodia with nothing but like a torch or like the weakest headlights you've ever seen. And that just shows you how punishing that climb must have been. Because I know, like, I haven't done like mountain climbing on a bike, but I'm no stranger to hills. And it gets to a point where it's like hot in your lungs, isn't it? And your legs feel like they're going to, mm-hmm. like, your quads are going to peel off the bone. And then there's like, honk, honk, like straight behind you. Absolutely fuming. Oh my days.
It was really stressful. I just hope I'm painting this picture the right way. Just imagine you're in just a really, really beautiful place. Like, try and imagine the most beautiful place you can think of. And then just imagine being stressed out of your fucking mind. with cars queuing up behind you and your legs are burning and your body's giving up and your mind is like, you're a fucking idiot. So, and then you can't turn around. You couldn't turn around because the cars on the other lane were flying past because there was no idiot cyclists stopping them. So they were just shooting out. And because the road was windy, it was blind corners everywhere. So you didn't know when a car was coming the other way. So we were stuck. We just had to keep going up this hill. But yeah, I don't know why I kept... I know why I kept going because it was literally no way to stop. Yeah. But Jack, she handled it a bit better than me. I know she was stressing her out, but she was in front of me and she kept pushing. And I was like, right, if she's pushing, I'm pushing, we're going to get there. And eventually, as with all mountains, as I've learned now, that was the first lesson. Eventually, you get to the top. You can see what you've done. We looked back and we saw Barcelona in the distance. There was like a picnic area up at the top. So there was space to get off the road and sit and have something to eat and look at the sea. We looked back, there's Barcelona in the distance. So we saw what we'd done. And we looked ahead. And then there was that town Sitges that we're trying to get to. And it was just downhill from there. And it was
beautiful,
amazing. And every hill's the same. You kill yourself going up them, but there's always the top. And then after the top, you just fly down it.
What a great analogy for the benefits of struggle, man. Like, what a great... It's perfect, man. You need struggle in your life because you will get to the top and then the rest of it's downhill, man. Absolutely sweet. I feel blissful just hearing that. Like, I can imagine sitting down at the picnic table feeling absolutely fucked, turn around and be like, oh, I can actually enjoy this now for the first time in like 6 hours or however long it took you. I can actually rest and appreciate what's going on. But you know what? I think that probably made your mind up, didn't it? Getting up to the top of that first hill and being like, oh, so this is the flip side of the coin, or?
It did until we tried to find somewhere to sleep. that first night we slept in a roundabout. And look, it was a pretty decent roundabout as roundabouts go. It was like quite a big one, like way bigger than your average roundabout. And it had like it was like surrounded by trees, so no one could see you in there, which was quite nice. We've got these bikes, we've got equipment, we've got guitars and things. We don't really want to be seen camping anywhere, just in case someone kind of grabs a bike while we're trying to sleep, which never really happened in the end. But at the beginning, we were super worried about things like that. Yeah. So after this beautiful downhill, we're looking for somewhere to sleep. And before this trip, I told you, we read about these blogs. They're like, you're going to be camping in beautiful forests on mountaintops. You'll wake up next to a lake for a swim. And then, you know, there we are in a fucking roundabout. the whole night, you could hear cars coming around the roundabout, but your head's on the floor. It kind of sounds like the rumbling's coming towards you. I couldn't sleep a wink. And then, you know, of course, my legs are burning from the only exercise I've ever done in my life at that point. It was an achievement that first day, though. It definitely was.
Yeah, that sounds like an understatement, man. I think you're really, really understating how much of like a nightmare that must have been. Honestly, it sounds like a character building experience, like a character defining experience, really. I just think it's incredible that you did it, really, because I can try and picture myself right now doing that. And just giving up.
Nah, you wouldn't, man. You'd be all right. If you had it's what Flynn said, he had someone with him who was willing to push through the uncomfortable stages. And once you, like, that's why I think it would be crucial doing that with two people. Mm-hmm. But just a quick question, Flynn. Did you wild camp the whole way? Because that's one of the things that in the UK, wild camping is like, obviously everyone does it, but you will get moved along if like people in certain counties catch you. So did you just be like, oh, let's find somewhere a little bit removed from the road after the initial roundabout and just like somewhere that's a bit covered? Was that your general thinking? Or?
Yeah, sir. I'd say about 90% of the 10 months of camping was wild camping, maybe more. At the beginning, we were always really concerned about not being seen. As we got more confident with it, we didn't care at all. We'd set up behind like a petrol station. And eventually, those blogs were right. Eventually, when we got into rural Spain, we were camping in like just huge forests next to lakes. We woke up next to lakes a bunch of times, and that's it. Jump in for a morning swim, make some breakfast, and then get back on the bike. To get to your point about the laws in the UK, yeah, they're a bit stricter. In Spain, with wild camping, as long as you put the tent up after dark and get it put away before the sun comes up, you're okay. Though we never got up before the sun come up, but no one ever, we never had any trouble at all or anything. It was, yeah, there's no problem with the wild camping.
You moved on to Morocco after that. You had to get a ferry from the southernmost point of Spain.
Yeah.
So how did that work? So why did you decide to continue on? You've done what, 10 months, did you say, in Spain?
10 months in total. So I think we got to Morocco about 3 months in, I think.
All right. So what made you decide to carry on?
So we never had a big plan, but at one point we got it into our heads that we were going to go around the Iberian Peninsula, you know, Spain and Portugal. We thought, let's lap this peninsula. That would be a good achievement. So about halfway through that, 3 months cycling, I think it was about 3 months, we got to a town, like you said, the southernmost point of Spain and the southernmost point of Europe. There's a town called Tarifa. Pardon me. When you get to this town, we were looking out to the sea, and it was at this point, it's a really interesting geographical point in the world. It's where the Mediterranean Sea meets the Atlantic Ocean. So I remember we finally made it there. I remember looking across the water and seeing some mountains in the distance. Now, I thought, oh, we're obviously like in a bay or something, and what I'm seeing is just the other side of the bay, and it's still Spain. But Jack was like, no, I think that's Africa, you know. And I was like, no way, impossible, that's not Africa. And then, yeah, it turned out like, I think on one of these viewpoints, there was a big sign explaining what you're looking at from the viewpoint, and it said, yeah, these are the mountains of northern Africa and Morocco. And you know, once you see another continent like that, you gotta go check it out, haven't you?
Yeah
you have to.
Completely agree.
Well, you've gotta go check it out, mate. I don't think, like, you know, your whole attitude towards like, oh yeah, I'll do that, like, you've always been like that as long as I've known you, where I'd be thinking like, I'd like to do that, but the things that are stressing me out about that are probably going to stop me from doing it. Whereas you are like, yeah, I will absolutely do that. You might get thrown in the deep end once or twice, but you always do tend to swim. Do you know what I mean? And I'm like, yeah, I've got to touch that continent. Completely encapsulates your personality, man. Well done.
And Flynn, did you have any sort of scary encounters with any wildlife, either in Spain or Morocco?
We did. More times, we saw a lot more wildlife in Spain, funnily enough. For some reason, I thought I'd see a lot more in Morocco, but we did see some in both countries. But so I hate snakes. I don't know if you guys know this. I've always hated like animals with no legs. I just I don't know what they're thinking.
Can't trust an animal with no legs.
Yeah, what are they thinking? Where are they going?
Discrimination.
I don't care.
I'll stand by. I'll stand by anti-snake movement. Give us our snakes back.
So, yeah, I hate snakes. And there was fucking hundreds of them in Spain. A lot of the time you'd see dead snakes on the road. You'd sometimes see live ones like basking in the afternoon sun on the road. That always freaked me out. That always made me swerve big to pass them. But there was one time we were camping in quite a nice forest, I think in the south of Spain. And like, we'd have days off because you can't be cycling 8 hours a day every day. So yeah, sometimes we'd take a day off, we'd take a few days off. It depended how nice the campsite was. I say campsite, like the spot we'd found. And this was a really nice sort of forest with a village nearby. So we could go, one of us could run into the village and get some food to eat for the day. And we'd just chill reading books and playing those guitars that actually did get some use. Yeah. We had a hammock. I remember lying on the hammock. Jack had gone into the village to charge a laptop because, you know, you got to have movies to watch when you're in the tent. She went into the village to charge a laptop. I'm on the hammock reading a book. I think it was the Great Gatsby or The Road, one of those two books, I think, because it's a book about a big, long trip. So it worked pretty well with that. So, yeah, I remember lying in this hammock, enjoying whichever book I was reading. And there was a load of dead leaves on the floor, and there was loads of lizards, like, in this part of the forest, which was kind of cool. They've got legs, you see, so I don't mind them.
trustworthy.
Trustworthy. And, I remember watching them. You'd hear the leaves rattle or rustle, and then you'd look down, you'd see a lizard running around. They were only small, and I remember watching them eating the flies and things like that, and I thought, this is really cool. And then at one point, I heard the rustle again. And imagine you're lying on a hammock. You hear a rustle underneath you. So I look down just underneath me and I see the head of a lizard, but it didn't move like a lizard's head does. It was going from side to side. And it just took two seconds. I was like, snake. And I didn't even think. The next thing I knew, I was on the other side of the forest. I just ran.
Standard.
But then this was right next to the tent. And, you know, the tent's open. I don't want to deal with a snake in the tent. So I was like, right, I best at least go back and see where the snake is. And I remember I got back to the hammock. I ran quite far away from it, if I remember right. I remember it was quite a walk to get back. there was just a snake. Just, yeah, I think he was as scared as I was. He was just lying there dead still underneath the hammock. And I was like, well, Jack's Australian. She's going to know what to do with snakes. So I'm just going to keep an eye on this guy. And it was like a Mexican standoff, me and the snake, just like staring each other out for a good 20 minutes or so. And then I see Jack in the horizon. And I was like, hey, there's a snake. And she's like, oh, cool. She comes over. I was like, what do we do? She's like, I'm fucking nope. It's not Crocodile Dundee.
I thought you were going to say, she comes over with a stick. She's like, he's looking pretty agitated. I'm going to poke this little fella with a stick.
But she didn't know what to do either. And then eventually it sort of slithered into the leaves that were covering the ground. And it slithered in the most disgusting way. Like, the first half of its body slithered forward while the second half stayed where it was. Then the front stayed still and the second half followed. And it was like, I shudder thinking about it now. And then, of course, he went back into the leaves. We went back into the tent when it got dark and I didn't sleep a wink again. I had some really good sleeps on this trip, you know, after cycling 8 hours all day and then getting into a nice tent. But that night, every single noise woke me up then. And I haven't ever gone to the toilet comfortably since. I just check for snakes. I don't know why.
I was going to say, I feel like you could live in Australia when they're like chilling underneath the toilet seat and that, or coming out through the hole. Like,
they are the embodiment of Satan though, aren't they? To be fair. So he's probably right to be on your awares.
I think a lot of us have evolved to have like a fear of snakes. Even though, you know, it's not always rational these days, especially in Europe, there's not many venomous ones around. This one was venomous.
Same with spiders as well, isn't it? Misunderstood creatures, man.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think, should we wrap that up? I think that was fantastic. I'm really, really glad you shared that with us, man. That was captivating, man.
Cheers. Yeah. Thanks a lot. Thanks for hearing me out.
The roundabout one's the best one. Like, fuck. Like, no one can see us here, but I can hear everything.
I could hear voices. I could hear some kids. I could hear a basketball bouncing off the floor at one point. That was fucking horrible.
Nice little tip that is for me. I've taken a few lessons from that little account there, man. Nice one.
I'm glad.
And if I ever decide to go cycling, which will definitely never, ever happen, do you know what I mean? On a world tour.
I will sign off with... It was the thing I'm most proud of in my life. It was a huge adventure. I'll never forget it. There's, those are just a few examples of a couple of nights, but this was a life-changing event for the both of us. And we're still best friends. And whenever we see each other, this is like 5 or 6 years later, that's what we talk about. It's always like, hey, do you remember that town in the middle of Morocco when them kids... Your bike broke and then 20 kids in the whole village came to help fix it. Wow. And they took us home and gave us dinner. Wow. I'd recommend it to anyone who doesn't mind stinking a shit all the time because there's not many showers. If you can put up with that side of it, it was, yeah, the best thing I've ever done.
That was genuinely heartwarming, man.
Should we go on to it? Should we move on to the 5 things you might have missed then? Yeah.
Let's do it, man.
All right, so number one, cameras caught Canelo and Caleb Plant's embrace. So this is going to make you feel emotional after Flynn's just poured his heart out about his journey around the globe. So following their middleweight matchup last weekend, if it doesn't make you tear up, go and watch it, man. You ain't human if it don't make you tear up. It really is what combat sports is all about, giving it all in the ring, you know, showing your love and respect after the fight. Caleb, like, sort of embraced him afterwards, and he just said, I'm sad. And yeah. Canelo was like, look, don't be sad, man. Like, you gave it your all kind of thing, didn't you? And then obviously they mentioned the fact that he said, oh, you know what I said about call you motherfucker. Yeah. I'd never say anything like that. I don't mean it. Like my mum isn't here. Do you know what I mean? And I was like, bruh, this is making me feel like sad, man.
The way Canelo embraced him and says, look, we're fighters, we're men. He's like, don't be sad. He's like, you can be proud of yourself. You're a great fighter, all this. But yeah, Caleb Plant, he's like, for him to be like, I think he called him a motherfucker. And Canelo was like, what are you talking about, my mom? And he just punched him up. But then I think that must have stuck in Caleb Plant's mind afterwards. He's like, I actually wasn't saying that. I was trying to roll you up. I wasn't trying to actually like talk about your mom.
Yeah, it took out context, like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, for him to say that after the 11th round, after he's just been stopped, exhausted, hurt, and for that to be on their mind, like that was like a really like a heartwarming moment for two geezers who just beat the shit out of each other for half an hour, man. It was a good example of sportsmanship and camaraderie.
And I think boxing's unique in that regard. You don't see that with other sports that often. I think because you're putting so much on the line and you're up against a guy that's literally like putting their soul into what they're doing, innit? And so I think boxing's unique in that regard. You don't really see it in other sports. So it was, let's hope we can see more of that. You know, I mean, that's what we want to see more of in post fights. Yeah, we can have all the sort of like all the banter and all that sort of showmanship prior to the fight. And that's what we want to see post fight, innit?
But it's also they physically completely spend themselves. So like it's difficult to be mad at someone when you're absolutely exhausted, which is probably why Bryson DeChambeau and Brooks Koepka still... Oh, the Segway King's back. Did you miss me? Did you miss me? It's because they've had this rivalry going on for, it's got to be months now, man. They've been pecking away at each other, very passive aggressive, like coughing and like, do you know what I mean? Trying to knock each other off his games. And I think it's simmering just for the fact that they're just swinging clubs for a bit. I'm not saying golf isn't physically taxing, but there's definitely a residue left over from these kind of rivalries in non-combat sports.
Yeah, and Capital One's the match, which is going to be on November 26th, which is like, it's going to be like a 12-hole match play event, and it will feature unprecedented access with these two players having open mics throughout the entire competition, including the capability to communicate directly with the competitor, which is all, I feel like this is the first time they've done it. It's been particularly tailored to these two because they know for a fact it's going to be absolute comedy gold. I would say the best golfing rivalry since Shoot McGavin and Happy Gilmore. So it's going to be worth a watch.
I eat pieces of shit like you for breakfast.
You eat pieces of shit for breakfast?
Oh, it's a classic. Isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great film. Number three, Aston Villa defender Matty Cash makes his Poland debut. Yeah, you heard that right. And joins the list of international footballers digging out one of their parents' birth certificates. And by a strange stroke of misfortune, his fit missus, Katie McDermott, as seen on Love Island, split with the 24-year-old just days after his cap last week.
Hey, look, I can't say I blame him for playing for Poland, not about the girlfriend. But by all accounts, this guy's like a really good right back. But it's not exactly like England are crying out for more right backs at the moment. So this is his only chance, I take it.
Yeah, they took four to the Euros, didn't they?
Yeah, the four-man queue at the Euros. And then Trent Alexander-Arnold got injured. So it was like looking all right, like Southgate donned it yet again, even though you hate him. Bishop, so about that.
I don't hate Southgate, man. I don't know where you get this from.
Even when you said the word hate then, it sounded like you really fucking hated him. I hate the guy. Right?
I think we get it from you constantly shitting on him.
Yeah, it's a bit weird, Saz.
Just highly critical of England managers. You have to be highly critical of England managers, or else we're never going to win anything, are we?
Good point.
There you go. And what about is it going to be more players, do you think, in the future that are going to sort of like play for strange countries that you'd never thought they would ever be eligible for? Does this pave the way? Because cricket has had this for quite a while. You know, you've got a lot of players that turn out for England. Kevin Peterson, like who is South African. I don't know where the part of him is English. You've got Owen Morgan, who's very Irish. And then there's a few more. I think there was a wicketkeeper whose name escapes me that was like very Welsh. I suppose those two are a little bit closer to home, but players that come from South Africa. Obviously, I'm not saying that you, like, if you're born here, you have to play for that nation. But I feel like the gap is widening for players to be able to play for other countries internationally. What do you reckon?
The gap's been there for a long time. Stan John played for Ireland, do you know what I mean? That's just
no, he didn't. You did Clinton Morrison. Trinidad and Tobago, he played for. But yeah, Clinton Morrison. Yeah, played for Ireland.
He's one of Trinidad and Tobago's finest. I can't believe I just put my foot in it like that. We were talking about him the other day as well, weren't we? Him and Dwight York and the boys. Shaka Hislop and the lads.
Yeah.
I think honestly, Diego Costa, do you know what I mean? Played for Brazil, then he played for Spain.
Aymeric Laporte. He was, you know, he played with France up until Spain up until U21 and then played for, which way is it? It's either way. I think he plays for Spain now and he played for France up until the age of U21. So then he went over to play for the Spain national team. So, and he was born in France, I believe. So yeah, I think it has been happening for a while, but I do feel like players are just digging. If they want to play internationally and they know they're not going to play for, say, England in terms of Matty Cash, even though he was 24, there was still opportunity for him to get a look in for England. But I feel like they're digging out their parents' birth certificates.
It's been going on for a really long time. I was looking into it a little bit for people who have played for England and then played for other teams. And it goes back as far as the late 1800s. But it was usually like the neighbouring countries like Ireland, Wales, Scotland. But yeah, this has been going on for a really long time.
Right, the dog, if you can hear that tappity-tappity-tap, it's the dog. I'm just going to let him out quickly because...
I can see him wagging his tail. Yeah, let him out.
India's back at the shopping, man. She was loving a shout-out last week about folding the clothes as well. She texted me, man. I'm going to get a bollocking for that. One sec.
All right, number four, Fallon Sherrock checked out 170 against Belgian Gabriel Clemens to become the first ever woman in the knockout stages of the Grand Slam of Darts. Remarkable achievement and paving the way for more female success in the future in cross-gender sports. So this is an important moment in history, really. I think there's going to be, this is definitely going to be more common in the future in sports like darts, in sports like snooker. What do you think?
Yeah, we've seen it in the snooker, didn't we? Those ex-lovers played each other in a really high-stakes game, really competitive to the end. But I think in this kind of format where physicality is reduced to its barest minimum, I think that's the most fairest environment to have it in. I'm not talking like sprinting and like high explosives, like football. Do you know that kind of stuff? It does become unfair after a point. So I think this is, like, as you say, a great entry into the world of cross-gender competition.
Yeah, I think sports like this that aren't necessarily weighted on your physical attributes, I think this is where men and women can compete a lot more fairly. So, yeah, I can't think of any other examples. Obviously, there was another, I think, Van Gerwen, when he was playing against a woman as well. So I think it's becoming ever present, really, in these sort of sports now.
That's good. It's good. Like back in the day, they had that tennis match between the man and woman, didn't they? Like the... But did Serena Williams or Venus Williams play the men's ranked 100 and something and got absolutely smashed a bit? It's not the one, really, is it? For like the whole appeal of the ideal, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't think that's a good... Yeah, it's never going to be a good comparison doing that, is it? Like that was never going to turn out well for women's tennis, was it? Do you know what I mean? So I think the more women can avoid those scenarios, the better, I'd say. So number five is a bit of a dark one. You pointed this out in the group earlier, Flynn, and it's something that I'd sort of heard Naomi Osaka particularly talking about. And so she's joined the WTA in expressing concern of the whereabouts of Chinese tennis player Peng Shuai after she made sexual assault allegations towards a Chinese ex-government official on social media 2 weeks ago. So Chinese state-controlled media released a supposed email from the tennis star yesterday, but many have doubted its validity. In the email, she described the news being released on the WTA as including the allegation of sexual assault is not true. So it was a very sort of like loosely worded email. And this is funny considering just 2 weeks ago, she posted on Weibo, which is basically like Chinese Twitter. Speaking of her alleged rape experience, she said, "Why did you have to come to me? Took me to your home and to force me to have sex with you. I never gave consent, crying the whole time. I couldn't describe how disgusted I was and how many times I asked myself, am I still human? I feel like a walking corpse." Now, that does not sound to me like a woman that is ready to back down 2 weeks later and say it never happened.
There's also something interesting about that second email, the one that is clearly not written by her. Someone on Reddit has noticed something quite interesting. In the screenshot that was tweeted by the Chinese state-affiliated media, you can see a cursor on the third line of text. So, you know, when you're using Word and there's that little flashing vertical line that tells you where you are in the document and you press the letter A and the letter A appears where that cursor is. So that cursor is visible on the screenshot. And what that suggests is that we're actually looking at a screenshot from something like Microsoft Word and not actually a received email, because you wouldn't see that cursor. It's usually only seen when creating or editing text. So it could very well be that what we're looking at is a screenshot of the creation of this text or a screenshot of someone changing or editing the text. Another interesting point here is that the CEO of the WTA, Steve Simon, has released a statement saying that he has a hard time believing that the second email was written by Peng Shui. And Time Magazine have also reported that he has threatened to move all WTA tournaments out of China, which is quite, I was quite surprised to see, actually. You don't often see people of that stature going against the CCP.
That is absolutely, that's like blatant. It's like, oh yeah, it's almost as if they're leaving breadcrumbs to let you know, like, yeah, we disappeared her, but we're gonna put up this little facade here. Now, bear in mind, like, I've never been to China. I think I've only met one Chinese person, which is Bissett's lovely wife, Jess. And I've got nothing concrete to base my opinions on, but I absolutely believe it.
Yeah, no, so do I as well, to be honest. And the same thing happened. First off, big up the vigilante detectives on Reddit, man. I absolutely love Reddit as a platform and how they get mm-hmm. deep into this sort of things. There's been a lot of issues with sort of like censorship and stuff like that. Even Jackie Ma, who's like one of the most, he's like what I think he's owner of Alibaba and, mm-hmm. and various other sort of companies. He's basically the richest man in China. Like people like wondering where he went for like 2 or 3 months. He just went off the grid for 2 or 3 months after sort of saying something about the government. And then he came back and was sort of like there. And it was just like, what is going on, man? Like it's a really weird sort of scenario, isn't it? And I know that obviously in China, they have restrictions on social media. So obviously you're not meant to use Facebook, Twitter, WhatsApp, and a lot of these sort of different social media platforms. But obviously you can just use a VPN if you really wanted to. But and they have their own versions of these social media platforms. But this is particularly concerning.
I do actually think it's true. That makes me really sad. And like the fact that this happens on the regular to people who they've got no voice and they've got no way to tell the world. People who probably believe in the ideological system they're in, whether we believe in it or not, like that, not quite totalitarian, but pretty much totalitarian vibe. People believe in that shit and that's, you know, the way they're brought up and they don't want to speak out against their country. If that kind of attitude bred into you, then it's going to be hard to go against it, even if you're a grown person and you try and expand your mind and all that good stuff. But I get the feeling that like people like this young woman who's allegedly suffered a sexual attack from a person of high status in China, it's like you can't do anything about it. But is that any truer in China than it would be here? I don't know, man. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's a good point, and it's hard to discern it sometimes. I feel like because we're in this sort of environment that we are, do we sort of look at things, you know, without thinking about it, we look at things differently. Do you know what I mean? So I think the way we perceive our own sort of environment is going to be a lot different to the way we perceive China. Do you know what I mean? And, and in China, they're going to be the opposite. So yeah, I think we'll sort of like leave that there and we'll sort of lighten the mood up with the quiz, which Jim is going to be desperate to regain his status because Flynn's holding the belt. So this is the big grudge match from last week. Flynn took the title.
The King's
which way is it going to go? I think the King's got to stay there, innit? Who's the money
bullshit
on?
This is bullshit, man. The King's back right here, man.
If you come at the King, you best not miss.
Nah. But the King, stay the King. And I'm the motherfucking King.
Fighting talk, right?
I don't know, man. The last week's score says otherwise, but...
Yeah, Flynn, I think you've your time on this podcast is up, mate. I don't really like this attitude.
So I've changed the format. Again, slightly, just a tailor for both. Yeah, really. And I've only got 3 questions. One of them is going to be tailored to Jim and one of them is tailored to Flynn. So I'm hoping that I've weighted it fairly. And then the third one is going to give you both an opportunity to score points. So the first one for Jim is going to be worth 3 points. Flynn's is going to be worth 3 points. And the last one's going to be worth, I think it's 9 points, but we're going to decide whoever's winning after the first question that's tailored to you, whoever's got the most points gets to go first.
Great.
I'm making this form up as I'm doing it. So yeah, hopefully it's going to work. Right. So the first question's for you, Jim. Are you ready? Competitors, are you ready? All right. So, England's game on Monday night was the first time since November 2014 that three Arsenal players started for England. Can you name who the three players were?
Is that for the game on Monday or the game in 2014?
No, it was from the game in 2014. Should we say 60 seconds? Flynn, you got a timer? You put the timer on, mate.
Okay, 3, 2, 1, go.
Theo Walcott.
No.
Bastard. Jack Wilshere.
Yes.
And this is one I thought Walcott was a fucking shoe in there, man.
That's threw you right off, innit?
Threw me right off. Yeah, I'm doubting myself. I'm gonna go a bit west and say Callum Chambers.
Nope.
Ah, go on then. Hit me with it. Hit me
you
with it.
You got 30 man. Seconds. Come on, just keep working at it. Jack Wilshere's era, man.
Jack Wilshere's era.
Both of the players are still playing in the Premier League, but for different clubs.
I can't, there's too many options. God damn. I can't do it. Slipping away.
Liverpool. Liverpool.
Oxlade-Chamberlain.
Yes, there you go. Right, wow. I'll do. All right. And the last one was Mr. Danny Welbeck.
Oh, I would have never got Welbeck. Well, I hope you're... Thank you for the clue. And obviously, reciprocate on Flynn's end as well.
Yeah, obviously, I'm not gonna leave Flynn in the dark.
Two out of three, man. I would. You know what?
Two out of three ain't bad.
Freedom isn't free.
All right, so two out of three. So Flynn, if you get three out of wait, hold on. You've got more of a chance. You got a possibility of getting seven, but so there's oh, the right. sort of, but you ain't gonna get seven. You just ain't. So yeah, so you'll see in a minute, Jim. Don't give me those eyes.
Why these Takeshi Castle rules?
So yeah, are you ready, Flynn?
Yep.
So this your question's going to be, just because you know you're a bit of a cycling connoisseur.
Oof.
I'm going to get you to name me three riders with three or more Tour de France victories. So I'm going to give you 90 seconds. I think that's fair, because there's some horrible ones in here that I've never heard of. I'm going to get the timer on, because I've got these answers in front of me.
I don't know loads of professional cyclists, but. Let's do it. Let's have a go.
I think there's at least two that you should be able to get. Okay. All right. I'll give you 90 seconds. 3, 2, 1, go.
Lance Armstrong?
Yes. Seven times.
Bradley Wiggins?
No, he didn't win it. I think he won it twice.
Three or more. Is it Chris Hume? Is he just an Olympic?
Froome. I'll give you that. Chris Froome. Yeah. He won it. Three times.
Three times. All right. Trying to think of... Any names that are coming to mind?
Any French names? Any French names that come to mind?
Oh, I watched 30 seconds. Last year as well. Oh, nah. Nothing's... any Colombian lads in there? They tend to win quite a bit, don't they?
There's an Italian in there, aren't there?
No, I don't think there's an Italian.
Anyone called Rodriguez?
No. I thought, when I was looking through this, I thought Alberto Contador would be in there, but he's only won it twice.
Right. Okay.
A bold one.
Who is Lance Armstrong's sort of teammate?
The rest of the guys are foreign. Okay. I think a lot of them are French.
I don't know any French cyclists. Let's see, do we know any French surnames that might work?
Go for it. just start saying our car names, French car names.
Peugeot.
Nope.
The other one.
Is any dudes called Remy?
Yeah, it's kind of, we'll have to leave it there. That was tough. There was Jacques Anquetil. Eddie Merckx, who I have heard that name rings a bell. Bernard Hinault, Miguel Indurain. They all won five times. And Louison Bobet and Greg LeMond won three times each.
LeMond.
So you're both on two. Both on two. I think Flynn's was difficult, to be
fair. That was hard, man. That was hard.
And considering Flynn is the current champion, he will get the tiebreaker and he'll get the first 60 seconds for the final question. All right. So are we ready?
Okay.
So after I was bemoaning another international break where England played pointless games, we pondered over San Marino's position in the FIFA World Rankings. Lo and behold, they were in 210th place, dead last out of all the FIFA recognized footballing nations. I'm going to give you both 60 seconds each. Should we do this at the same time and you shout answers out, or do you think we should go with this format where Flynn gets to go first and Jim can go second?
I don't mind if we shout them out.
Yeah, I'm happy to share.
Is that the fairest way to do it? Will you both just shout them out?
Yeah, go on.
So that's what we're going to do. So you need to, I'm going to give you 60 seconds for both of you then at the same time to name who are in the nine places ahead of San Marino, the immediate nine places ahead of San Marino in the FIFA World Rankings, current FIFA World Rankings for the men's. So that is your task. So are you ready? All right, 3, 2, 1, go.
Isn't that like Anguilla or something? Oh.
Flynn, 1 point to Flynn.
St. Vincent and the Grenadines?
Nope.
Vanuatu?
Luxembourg.
What did you say, Flynn?
Vanuatu?
No. And Luxembourg, no.
Andorra?
Andorra? Nope.
St. Helena?
Nope.
Swaziland?
Nope.
Haiti?
South Sudan?
Nope. Ooh,
good one.
Cheers. China?
Nope.
North Korea?
Nope. Think US territories that aren't in America.
Guam? Yes. Puerto Rico?
Virgin Isles?
Yes. Yes to Guam.
US
Virgin Isles? Yes. 2-1 to Flynn.
Trinidad and Tobago?
Nope. Marshall Islands?
Nope.
Cook Islands?
St. Kitts?
Nope.
St. Kitts? You always hear of them.
That's it. Time's up.
Bastards. Fuck.
I think that's 2-1 to Flynn. So I think Flynn retains the title.
Boom.
Do you want to hear them? So yeah. They were...
No, I don't want to hear them. I do not want to hear them.
Aruba, Bahamas, Eritrea, Sri Lanka, who are obviously a better cricket team than they are a football team, Turks and the Caicos Islands, Guam, US Virgin Islands, British Virgin Islands. So I'll give Flynn just 1 point because he just said Virgin Islands, and yes. Anguilla, which Flynn got as well. So there you go. Flynn takes it 4 points to 3, I believe, wasn't it? Yeah.
Congratulations, Flynn.
Don't worry about it. Look, you can try again next week. We'll see if, yeah.
So Flynn, congratulations to Flynn on your title defense. And we're going to move on straight into the combat sport. So we've got about 20 minutes, boys. I know this. I wanted more time for sure, but we're going to have to wrap it up in 20 minutes.
So I'm for the combat sports section, and sitting here last week, I didn't expect Kiko Martinez to become the IBF featherweight champion, but Kid Galahad, the defending champ, was handed his ass to him for 4 and 4/5 rounds. Kiko survived an early onslaught, absorbing a good uppercut and the follow-up. And as the rounds wore on, I thought to myself, he might have been better off. But that's why I'm sitting here jacking it. And he's a two-weight world champion, age 35. He was slinging hooks from the beginning, but Galahad was just peeling away, managing to counter. In the fourth, we got a little glimpse of what was to come, though. Galahad was in the corner with nowhere to go, and Kiko landed a right hook that Galahad took clean but absorbed quite well. After that, Kiko threw a lot more right hands, straights and hooks, and landed a fair few. But regardless, there was very little to indicate to me that Galahad was about to get turned over. And with 17 seconds left in the fifth, Kiko gave Galahad the straight-up playground wombomb. Now, you watch it back and you tell me that's not what it was.
Anthony Reid special.
Oh, I'm telling you, man. Dribbling on the floor, all that. So Galahad was up at the count of 5, but very shaky. The bell to end the round came before Kiko could follow up. And in the corner, Galahad looked in trouble. The debate has gone on over whether Dominic Ingle should have stopped it. And that's up to them, isn't it? Like, they chose to send him out for the 6th round regardless. And Kiko ran straight up to him and did the exact same thing again. The ref waved it off. Kiko's the hardest kid in school, man.
Yeah, I mean, watching back the highlights, it looked like Galahad rocked Martinez in the first and like had him in real trouble in that first round. And obviously the Spaniard looked unsteady on his legs with around a minute and a half to go. Obviously, it's easy for us to speak retrospectively, like after the result went against him, Galahad. But did you, watching this fight, Jim, did you feel watching it that he should have thrown the gauntlet at Kiko then and there in that first round and try and end it?
Well, it's not really like Kid Galahad's style. He's not someone that really empties the clip on opponents. He's very considered, measured. He looks for the right punches at the right time, you know, and I've always considered him a very well-schooled fighter, which is, you know, some of the comments after the fight. Obviously, these lads are professionals. They're around the sport. Some of them are former world champions, like including Darren Barker, who attributed Galahad's defeat to schoolboy errors. And namely, pulling back with his chin straight in the air. He implied it wasn't so much a natural tendency of Galahad's, but a deficiency in the Ingle style. So that Sheffield gym, it tends to produce fighters who switch hit, they've got good foot movement, and they throw unorthodox punches from all kinds of different angles. Those are the types of fighters that Dominic and his dad, Brendan, tend to train up. Now, to be honest, I don't know about all that. I'm not saying that Darren Barker or the rest of them are wrong, just that I don't know enough to say either way. Now, I did notice that Galahad wasn't moving his head that much, but I also thought his foot movement was superb. And while he continued to switch stances, he offered enough variety with his movement to decrease the chances of taking a big shot. And obviously, I was massively wrong because he got dropped hard twice with the exact same punch. There's obviously a deficiency there somewhere.
And it weren't just you that was wrong, chap. Bookmakers were given anywhere in the region of 8-1 for Kiko Martinez to take the title, with Galahad as short as 1-16 with some bookmakers. So he was a heavy, heavy favourite. In layman's terms, this is as good as a certainty for the bookmakers. And they would have been happy to see money be thrown on Martinez. And especially considering in that sort of like in the first four rounds, like Galahad looked extremely comfortable and was like picking his moments really and just dominating the fight. But obviously, you know, whichever way you look at it, this is kind of like a surprise to the boxing world. Kiko Martinez came into this fight with a record of 42 wins and 10 losses. He fought Josh Warrington in 2017 and had a pretty contentious decision against him on the night in Leeds. You'll probably remember this one, Jim. When, you know, sort of Warrington was undefeated at the time, and many fans thought that possibly that Kiko Martinez should have won that fight. And Kid Galahad likewise went close with Warrington in a split decision back in 19. So there were some common denominators. I mean, could Galahad be accused of complacency, in your opinion, Jim? And what would you attribute the loss to?
You know, it sounds really simple, but like there's always going to be a chance of getting knocked out. And Kiko Martinez, I think I mentioned last week that I didn't see him as a knockover. He was robbed blind against Alpha Barrett. I don't think he won the fight against Josh Warrington, but I think he pushed him really close. And he's never shown himself to be anything less than competitive at the top level, even if he's consistently come up short. I mean, he's been competing for a long time, 42 and 10. That's a mad record. That's over 50 pro fights. He's 35. You don't usually see those kind of stats in the, especially in the lighter divisions. But I did not expect this to happen. For Galahad, I thought after he, was it Jazza Dickens he beat for the title? The vacant title it was, wasn't it? So like after he finally got his world championship belt, obviously he served the 18-month ban for like PEDs and all that. Said his brother spiked him. He's gained momentum, lost momentum, gained it. And when he got the belt, I just thought, this is him for a long time now. I couldn't really see many people beating him. This is a massive shock to me. So he doesn't strike me as someone who is lackadaisical, someone who rests on his laurels. The stories about him being in the gym the Monday after a fight, it's just standard. He's known as this iron-willed, super professional type of guy. It was just one of those things. Massive shot right on the button twice.
So at least we know he's going to come back strong from this and certainly be a contender for a long time. What age is he, Galahad?
I think he's 30 now, 30, 31, there or thereabout. I'm telling that this was... I'm shrugging my shoulders when you say that because you can't really assume. You don't know how that's going to affect the fighter. Obviously, he's going to come back, knock a few bowling pins over. But when he goes to the top level again, what if they rematch him with Kiko? To be fair, in the rematch, I really would favour Galahad, but I favoured him in the first fight and he got chinned. So.
And this is bad matchmaking by Eddie Hearn again. Do you know what I mean? What do you think?
No, it's not bad because you want world champions to fight credible opponents, don't you? Now, if your job as a promoter is to put on a boxing farce and watch your home fighter beat the shit out of someone overmatched.
A bit like Terence Crawford's been doing for however long.
I don't agree with that either. That's the...
We'll get into that in a bit then.
But yeah, I wouldn't say that's a bad matchup by Eddie Hearn. I think it was a bad night overall for him. And in retrospect, the co-main event was an omen for what was to follow because Terry Harper was stun-gunned into another realm by Alicia Baumgartner's right hand in the fourth round. I'd never heard of Baumgartner, but immediately she looked comfortable and capable. And you can tell if a fighter is stiff with nerves or generally doesn't have a certain level of mechanical ability. She was loosey-goosey in there, man. Hands low, feinting, jabbing to the body, moving from side to side. She'd wait for Harper to rush in, then launch the right hand, then circle away. Very composed, very balanced. They traded up in the second round and Harper was clearly shaken up by Baumgartner's punches. While her own had little effect, you can imagine how disheartening that is. I mean, Harper impressed me because in that kind of difficult situation, she fell back on her own training, like getting her legs moving, circling, throwing jabs. But Baumgartner stalked her, waiting for her opening. And it came in the fourth. Harper found a jab to the body. She reset, then came in with a jab to the head that Baumgartner could see coming from miles away. And as soon as Harper's left glove was about to touch her, Baumgartner whipped a vicious right hand over the top of it. And Harper, well, she froze and looked out into the crowd, and Baumgartner was already bearing down on her from behind. Like, she managed to swing in one final left as the ref was stopping it, but she was already unconscious, still upright, but unconscious. It was an impressive performance, a big up Baumgartner, Detroit's new WBC super featherweight champion. And like, at the beginning of the fight, commentators categorized her as just a power puncher, and she showed everyone that she is indeed that, but also a whole lot more as well.
And this is the first time that her name's been mentioned on this podcast. Obviously, it's the first time I've heard of her. Is there anyone else in that super featherweight division that she can be potentially put up against?
Well, I think Katie Taylor's at lightweight, isn't she? But I would, if I was Eddie Hearn, I would keep her well away from Baumgartner, man. You don't want to, like, you don't want to serve up your cash cow on the women's side to some killer from Detroit, Rock City, man. Absolutely not. But one more notable result from last Saturday's boxing cards. Jaime Munguia beat Gabriel Rosado over 12 in a very entertaining scrap. It's one of the rare fights where Rosado hasn't made a bloody canvas out of the ring. He went into this one with an upset knockout to his name and continues his late career resurgence with this performance, even while suffering his defeat. So Jaime Munguia moves to 38-0 with 30 knockouts, and he's still just 25 years old. Those are some Canelo stats right there.
That is incredible.
Absolutely nuts. But the final review of the week goes to Max Holloway and Yair Rodriguez in their UFC Fight Night main event. The Blessed Express rolls on with a unanimous decision win here. But Yair, after 2 years out and a string of injuries, he pushed one of the best in the division, nay, the entire company, to the limit. And I was very, very impressed by Rodriguez. Max edged the striking exchanges, stomping on the lead leg and meeting Yair with pushes to the chest, an approach that worked very well to deter the dangerous kicks that have become Yair's trademark. He worked his punches around these strategies, and to the extent we're used to seeing, his body punches were especially vicious. But Yair was always live in the fight and ready to do something big to end it at any moment. However, no matter what he landed, a kick to the head or the leg, a big punch, a sneaky upward elbow as Max rushed him, which I thought would have knocked out a lot of fighters in that division, he was never able to stop that forward march, like the relentless output, the pinpoint accuracy that Max is able to operate with. I did think Max could have finished the fight with a guillotine and a head and arm triangle in the third, but his head is in a completely different place. He's not looking for submissions. He wants to punch your head in. So if he's not next in line for Volkanovski, there's something seriously wrong. Yair by no means disgraced himself here. I'd like to see him against Calvin Kattar next, the one who Max Holloway absolutely destroyed a couple of months ago. It's a puncher versus a kicker, and both of them lost to Max, one in worse fashion than the other. But I think that's a good fight. And for this weekend, former bantamweight champion Misha Tate, she returns in a second post-retirement fight with Katie and Vera. Marco Chiesa and Sean Brady, chief support, not too fussed about that one, because I'm more interested in Terence Crawford and Sean Porter for the WBO welterweight title. Now, Bud Crawford is an undefeated three-weight world champion who unified all belts at 140 pounds. But because of a lack of marquee opponents at welterweight, such as Danny Garcia, who's now at 154, Keith Thurman, who's semi-retired after his last to Pacquiao, and Errol Spence Jr., who's indefinitely injured with a torn retina, Crawford's gained a strange reputation as someone who might not have achieved as much as he should have, which is mental. But that is just a perception thing as far as I'm concerned. Sean Porter, on the other hand, has fought all of the above, and Adrian Broner, and Kell Brook, and Joe Dennis Ugas, who beat Pacquiao last time out. Now, he may not have won all of these top-level fights, but his style, his earnest sense of competition, and his granite chin have combined with a likable personality to elevate him in some ways above Crawford in the general conversation about where they're at in their respective careers. But I see this as a genuine 50-50 fight, which is what all title fights should be, and may the best man win.
And you know how to lure me into a bet, you dirty dog. You really, really do. You're whetting my appetite. So the bookmakers see this as anything but a 50-50 fight, man. And they give in the region of 4-1 to Sean Porter, a similar price that was given for Alexander Usyk to beat our man Joshua when taking his belts away, like stealing candy from a baby. So would it be fair to say that Sean Porter is taking the riskier fights at the more dangerous moments in certain fighters' careers? He fought Kell Brook in 2014 when he was undefeated and arguably in his prime. When Crawford fought him 6 years later after losses to Triple G and Errol Spence Jr., Porter beat Adrian Broner in 2015 when his only loss was to Marcus Maidana. Many consider Terence Crawford one of the best or current best pound-for-pound fighters around, with the exception, of course, of the fabulous Saul Canelo Alvarez. But whispers of who has he fought, though, linger around the champ's name. What do you make of that, Jim?
Well, the case you just laid out for Sean Porter fighting the more dangerous competition at the prime of their careers, I don't think anyone can argue against that. Listen, people duck and dive from the fighters that he's made a career out of going up against on the highest level. Look, Errol Spence Jr., that man is an animal. And Sean Porter took him into a war. Keith Thurman, massive, massive puncher, great boxer. Sean Porter dragged every last bit of energy out of him. I heard a phrase on a boxing podcast I was listening to recently, and it was perfect. He said, Sean Porter is a truth machine. And it is, because you cannot be a fake fighter. You cannot be a paper champion. You can't be someone who's gassed up by your promoter and win a fight against him, because he's too competitive. He's too willing to win and go through absolute fire to do it. But I don't agree with the assessment that Terence Crawford hasn't fought anyone, because even going back to his lightweight days, he beat Ricky Burns. And say what you want about Ricky Burns, he was a long-standing lightweight champion, super featherweight champion as well. Longevity, chin, all that good stuff. Just not that mobile, not that quick. But I'm going to pull up Terence Crawford's box rec now, because I know there's a good few wins on there, man.
There are a good few wins. And he fought a lot of fighters that had one or two losses and heavy win columns. But then a couple of them have gone on to lose again since they lost to Crawford. So there's a bit of doubt about where they were in terms of their sort of like standing when he fought them. So that's the only thing that I'm going to sort of like bat against you there.
Yeah, but you can make the case that he damaged them and they were never the same after that, like Bernard Hopkins style. Let me just go
through leaning a few. Crawford, then you must be leaning Crawford.
I'm genuinely not, man, because like, okay, going back, Ricky Burns, 2014, good win. Uriorkis Gamboa. Gamboa was undersized, fair enough. Shouldn't have, he looked like a tiny kid in that fight, but that was like a fight of the year contender. Raymond Beltran, that's a great win, perennial title contender. Thomas Delorme, 22-1 at the time, has gone on to lose a lot more, but still credible contender at 140. Thierry Jean, probably a hyped up French-Canadian job, not really that impressive. Hank Lundy, same as Thomas Delorme, but in 2016, he fought Victor Postol. And I think that's probably one of the best names on his resume so far, because he was undefeated, 28-0. After this fight, Postol went on to give Josh Taylor probably the closest go of his career. And I think he might have won that fight. You know, I don't think that was as wide as the judges gave it. I remember watching that. Then you've got, I think what people hold against Crawford is that he managed to unify an entire division by taking two belts off Julius Ndongo. And Ndongo had beaten Ricky Burns, but he'd basically been hyped up with like one upset win in Russia, if I remember rightly. Eddie Hearn tried to make the easy payday for Ricky Burns and get Ricky Burns that fight with Crawford at 140. And it just all went to shit. Then he moves up. And then again, Jose Benavidez Jr., massively hyped. I think he got shot in the leg, had like a lot of time out of the ring, but still 27-0. Crawford chinned him in the 12th, I think. And then, and here's another underrated one, just before we wrap this up. Kavaliauskas, he fought this guy 2 years ago, right? He beat David Avanesian, who just wiped the floor with one of our hottest contenders, Josh Kelly. Kavaliauskas is a massive puncher. I think he dropped Crawford. I don't know if they've given it as a knockdown, but he did drop him, I think, in the fourth or the fifth round. Huge puncher. Crawford come back and stopped him in the ninth. That is a very credible opponent. And you can point to the Kell Brook and Amir Khan and say they were washed, but those are the money fights, aren't they? You have to go where the money fights are. He's been frozen out of all the big welterweight opportunities because of his allegiance with Bob Arum and Top Rank, and everyone else has been over the road at PBC. Classic boxing shit. And now we're going to see him. They both might be in their mid-30s. They both might have a lot of miles on the clock. But this is the best welterweight fight to make at the moment, I think.
Mate, you're whetting the appetite. And that is absolutely going to be something that we all need to watch out for. Everybody listen, watch that fight. Either stay up for it, get a few coffees on in the morning, or go to bed early, get up and watch it. Obviously, it's going to be somewhere in Vegas, I think, or somewhere in Nevada. So it's going to be an early one. But that is going to be such a scintillating fight to watch. We're going to wrap it up there. We were going to talk about Khamzat Chimaev, who's he's going to be one of our new sort of patron saints to the Ball Chat Sports podcast. But what I'm going to do is, and what we're going to do, we're going to move that to the preamble ramble next week so we can have a good old chinwag about it. Flynn's going to start us off with that next week. And then we'll have a good old chinwag about Chimaev and how much of a psycho he is. We'll round up there, lads. It's been a fantastic podcast. I loved hearing about Flynn's experience biking around Spain and Morocco. I think that was a great addition to the podcast.
That was wicked, man.
Looking forward to next week already, boys. Hopefully, in the next couple of weeks, we should be getting on Juan Tejada, who is a pro soccer player over here in the US. He plays for the Tampa Bay Rowdies. So your good friend Nicholas Jackson has hopefully put us in contact with him. So we should be looking to get him on in the next couple of weeks. And then we've got some more interesting news in the future. So that hopefully we can share with you around sort of early December time about someone else that we're going to get on that we can't say right now because I don't want to overpromise and him not come. But let's hope we can get more sort of interesting people for our listeners to listen to and sort of go through their sporting experiences. So cheers for another great episode, guys. Everybody listen, make sure you check out the socials. Tino's getting on them now. He's replaced Pizzy as a social media guy. And we'll see everyone next week.
Next week, man. It's been a pleasure, lads.
Been a pleasure.